Hey guys, and welcome to the Super Late Cinamateur Podcast. I am Josh, and I've got David here with me.
Hello.
And we have Billy on the phone this week.
From Cleveland!
Cleveland!
The home of a future World Series participant.
Hey!
At some point
this week.
In the future.
Alright, that's on record. That's pretty good. I feel like you guys can't complain as much anymore because you have a championship, but we're not here to talk about sports because that would be really bad for us as a group collectively. So instead, let's talk about movies.
Okay.
And let's just kick it off the way we normally do. And someone tell me about what you guys have seen lately.
So recently I've picked up The Nice Guys, which has now come out on Redbox. And film noir is a weird category for me because I feel like I should like it, but I never actually do like it as much as I want to.
And we're going to make Dave like it.
Yeah, we've needled Dave a lot about noir movies.
They're good, and I like the premise, but it gets so fucking slow sometimes.
Yeah.
Chinatown takes forever to get to the point. But The Nice Guys is nice because it takes, I don't know if that's a pun or something, but it's good because it has all the same film noir elements, but with a little more pace to it and a little more humor and not as much of like quietly smoking and then drinking yourself asleep at his desk.
The Nice Guys, I think, is the only movie I saw twice in theaters this year.
Mm.
So, indication of how much I enjoyed it.
I thought it was really good. I liked it a lot.
If only, yeah, you know what would be really good, Billy? Would be like a version of this movie, but like with Robert Downey Jr. in it.
Yeah.
And maybe like a holiday-ish type thing. That would be a great version. They should make that. Oh, wait. We've been telling Dave to watch it for forever.
Yes.
For those who don't know, The Nice Guys is kind of a love or like lovely secret sequel to, I don't know, that's not the right word.
It is, it's like a sister film. It's Kiss Kiss Bang Bang set in the 1970s instead of the early
2000s. It's Shane Black directed and wrote both of them. So
got it. I did not know that. I learned something today.
Yeah, so yeah. Now Kiss Kiss Bang Bang should move up on your list.
All right, I could do that because I really enjoyed this movie.
Yeah.
Good.
And the other movie I watched recently was Sicario, trying to catch up on some old movies from last year. It was fine. My problem with it is that in a world where Zero Dark Thirty exists, and it was just much less, I don't know, impactful for me. Maybe it's because I've learned more about like how the drug trade works, and I have a more pessimistic view on it. But when Sicario ended, I was just like, okay, so it's like Zero Dark Thirty, except sadder, and everything is more terrible, and the main leading character is just sad a lot and cries a lot. I was very depressed when I left, which is how I was supposed to feel, I think, but I was already depressed when my movie started, so it didn't really change my views.
I haven't seen Sicario. Billy, do you think I should see it after Dave's recommendation?
I definitely do. I mean, the whole point of the movie is, yeah, the war on drugs sucks, and you're smart to compare Zero Dark Thirty because there are a lot of parallels the movie draws between the war on terror and the war on drugs. Both of them being, you know, wars on common nouns, but I just love Villeneuve's style, the director. He's done a couple amazing movies besides that. Yeah, and I just think it's really, like, a great exercise in suspense. Emily Blunt is awesome. It's worth
checking out. Emily Blunt is awesome. And, yeah. And so, I mean, so is the other, oh god, Josh Brolin's in it, and
Benicio!
Benicio del Toro.
It's like a return to form for him. Yeah.
Yeah. The acting is really good, I'll give you that. This story just for me was like, I went into it thinking it would be depressing and I left depressed. So,
yeah. Mission accomplished.
I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe an expectations thing.
Yeah. So what about you, Billy? What have you seen?
I saw The Magnificent Seven in theaters.
Ooh. Was that good?
You know,
yeah,
it's very red boxable, I guess I would say. which is funny, like people say that. I like seeing movies like that in theaters more than because I feel like I'm not going to take the time to like sit down and watch that at home. But while it's on the big screen and it's a spectacle, like I'd just rather catch it then.
So I drove out the theater yesterday to see it, but I live in Columbus and there was a Ohio State game that day, so it was gonna cost me $20 to park to watch it. Are you saying I did a good thing in turning around and driving home?
It would not have been worth $20.
Okay.
Yeah. Plus the cost of the ticket. Yeah.
Have you seen the original?
I have. Yeah.
All I'm interested in is if someone said they were going to rent this for home, would you tell them to pick up this one or the original?
I would say the original.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
I mean, like, it's, listen, like, it was fun. Denzel and Chris Pratt are great, obviously. It just wasn't as much fun as it should have been.
I'm excited to see Chris Pratt in like a Western because it's not somewhere I've seen him at.
He's a natural in the role. Hard drinking, good. Funny guy. It's
because he kind of did like half of that in Jurassic Park, and I just want to go full. And
this,
I would
put this definitely leagues above Jurassic World, if that's any consolation. Okay. So, yeah.
Most things are above that.
Anything else?
Movie called Pride, about unlikely alliance between gay Londoners in the 1980s and striking Welsh miners. And it was what, like, I was donating platelets when I watched it. So, you know, you like sit in the chair with like two needles in you for 2.5 hours.
That sounds fun.
And I was like literally laughing and crying throughout the entire thing with all these nurses and like middle-aged dudes with needles in
and
their
And Billy
arms,
laughs
like,
really loud.
That's true.
That's true.
It's true. And I cry really softly.
Billy, can you please name your memoirs Hard Laugh, Soft Cry?
How much of the your review of the movie was affected by your loss of blood?
Well, that's a great question. I'm not, like, because I do get weirdly emotional when, you know, I'm losing blood. I think I'd have to watch it, like, totally not bleeding just to make sure it was good. But, yeah, I think it would hold up. Yeah. What about you, Josh?
I know. Well, before I did that, I know since I have a weird internet power that I get to scope on what people are watching when it comes from my movie server, that you saw Wreck-It Ralph, which I just wanted to pry you on because I loved that movie when it came out, and I feel like nobody talks about it anymore. And just
I put it in my categories of like Zootopia and Lego Movie as other really good kids movies, family movies that the parents, instead of having to turn on and then being like, hey, I can watch, you know, the basketball score on my phone, you can actually sit and watch the movie as a group. I really liked Wreck-It Ralph. I thought it was clever and funny and also poignant at times. And
it's my favorite thing.
It was good. I really enjoyed watching it. And absolutely, it has a good message at the end.
It's my favorite thing that Sarah Silverman's ever been involved with, I'll be honest, because I don't really like her that much usually. But I loved her. I thought she nailed the role of the little girl in the movie.
I can't recall anything that I liked Sarah Silverman in, so I'm going to go with yes on Wreck-It Ralph.
Yeah, she killed it.
Okay, well, yeah, that's good. I just wanted to make sure you liked it because I was a little nervous.
Oh, yeah, no, it's in the upper pantheon of family movies that I'm going to remember for when I have kids to be like, hey, we're going to watch Wreck-It Ralph today because this way daddy can enjoy it as well.
It's always surprising that happens from like non-Disney because like when Frozen did that, I was like, oh, it's Frozen. Of course it's going to be great.
Yeah.
Actually, Frozen took me away. I surprised you. That was a great year for kids movies. I think
Return to Form.
Wreck-It Ralph was in the winter and then, or in the December, like November area. And then afterwards we got
Lego Movie
and Frozen in the same winter, which is great.
It's like all the children's writers came together and like, let's do good movies this year.
Yeah. And then now we have Zootopia, which I agree with you is great. But
Zootopia's also great.
Going back to things I've actually seen recently, the first thing I saw was Terry Gilliam's Brazil, which has been on my list for a really long time, but finally came up on my random shuffle, so I committed to it and just kind of watched it. I don't know if you guys have seen Brazil. It's supposedly like a huge sci-fi classic. It was not the movie I was expecting based on all the cover and Terry Gilliam being involved, but it is very Terry Gilliam. It's a very weird world. But at the end of the day, I kind of thought that I know this is a cult movie. I'm not part of that cult. It was good, but it wasn't like spectacular, and it kind of got built up for me because it's always on like the greatest sci-fi list ever.
I've never even heard of this movie. Can you give me like a 2-second plot on it?
Yeah, so basically there's they live in this world. It's like huge bureaucracy type world.
Okay.
And this guy basically works for the records office for like the police department, and like, dude, it's really hard to describe this plot now that I'm thinking about it. It's like kind of insane. He falls in love with this girl and they're after the girl because she's like a freedom fighter of some kind. And so he's like trying to get her out, and he doesn't want to work for records cause it's boring, but they like move him over to like the actual investigation side. I don't know. And it's really like the coolest part of it is the world it's set in. Like, Robert De Niro's in it too. He breaks his air conditioner breaks, and he has to like call these people, and they come over, and they're like, his apartment is literally like boiling hot, and they're like, well, we can't fix it because we have to get this like X1C3 requisition form stamped, and to get that form, we have to submit this other form. It's that kind of humor. But then, like, Robert De Niro is wanted by the law because he comes in and fixes his AC without the forms. And so he's, like, a terrorist who comes in and fixes air conditioners.
That rat bastard.
That's, like, the kind of movie this is.
Okay. Sounds interesting now. I'm intrigued.
The world is really interesting. Like, it reminds me of kind of, like, the Mario Brothers movie universe mixed with, like, Hudsucker Proxy, which is a really weird mashup.
Yeah,
but, that is strange.
And it's Terry Gilliam. So if you like Terry Gilliam movies, which I do... I would just rank this like my third or fourth favorite Terry Gilliam movie.
Okay.
So not as great as I was hoping, because it's always in like Empire's number two sci-fi movie of all time, and it just didn't reach those heights.
Empire always picks movies that like no one's ever heard of, so they can feel special about themselves.
Well, they also have like a list of 500 always, so they have a lot
also
of room.
True.
But then I've also been to theater a couple times in the past few weeks, and I caught Kubo and the Two Strings. Which I don't know if you guys...
Is that a kid's movie or what? It's animated, right?
It's animated. It is a kid's movie.
That looks really good.
Falls directly into the category we're talking about, where it is a kid's movie with a lot of heart. And you can definitely watch it as an adult and have no problem. It's kind of the story of this kid who lives in the mountain with his mom. Like, they live in a cave. And you can tell they both have some kind of magic. It's not really clear what that magic is at first. And he only has one eye. And his mom basically is like, hey, man... You're not allowed to be out after dark because your grandfather and your aunts are going to come and they're going to try and take you away from me. Because his grandfather is called the Moon King, so he can see him at night. And then the kid stays out after dark and shit gets all sorts of fucked up.
Nice.
Which is a weird thing to say about a kid's movie. So,
don't stay after dark, kids. Everything will go to shit.
And then it kind of is like, there's a weird fantasy second act where Charlize Theron and Matthew McConaughey are involved, which is super fun. Charlize Theron plays a talking monkey, and Matthew McConaughey plays a beetle samurai.
Okay.
Awesome.
Yeah, sounds weird. It's great.
I'm
and
down.
It's, the animation is, it's claymation with a little CGI mixed in. So that was kind of, you know, nice to see. It's a little bit different.
That is cool.
It's getting a lot of emotion out of claymation, which I always like. I think it's really impressive. And it's, yeah, pretty great.
I always like Wallace and Gromit, so I mean.
Yeah, I think that, this is like a more beautiful version of that.
Okay, cool.
So, I saw Kubo. I also saw Mike Birbiglia's movie, Don't Think Twice.
Yes! Fucking
great.
Did you
see it?
My favorite movie I've seen probably this year.
Oh, mine actually is probably Zootopia or The Nice Guys.
That's close.
We both got brought up a little bit earlier. But Don't Think Twice is on that list, that short list, because it was very good. I'm a big fan of Birbiglia before, and it, like that cast is just, from top to bottom, just incredible. Like...
Yep.
The fact that Adam Pally is in there somewhere and is like the fourth or fifth name I'd mention just makes me really happy as a Happy Endings fan. But like you've got Keegan-Michael Key, Gillian Jacobs, Mike Birbiglia himself, Kate Micucci's in there. Yeah.
It's like a who's who of like alternate comedy.
Yeah, and it's about an improv troupe in New York City. Basically, one of them gets on the Saturday Night Live equivalent, but they can't use the word Saturday Night Live because it's an indie movie.
Sunday Night Live!
Weekend Live.
Oh, Jesus.
And then, so the rest of the troupe is kind of dealing with the fact that, like, this one guy got the job. But the thing that's really incredible about it is that it's like 85-minute movie, which is amazing, because I'm going to complain about Heat later. But they, in that same time, I think that at least 5 of the 6 of the troupe members, I would say, were fully rounded characters. Like, I knew what they wanted and what they were afraid of and, like, how they were dealing with it. And they weave all their stories together. Like, they have... an unexpected pregnancy, a death of a loved one, like someone getting that new job, somebody like coming to terms with their position in life, a breakup, like all of that in an 85-minute movie, and it doesn't feel rushed. It feels natural.
Yeah.
The whole
pacing
time.
Is incredible.
An ensemble movie, or is there a lead character with supporting characters?
I think you could argue that Keegan-Michael Key is the main, but I'd say ensemble movie.
Okay.
Yeah.
Impressed me. Yeah. And so if you're familiar with Mike Birbiglia at all, I would say definitely... check this out. I think it's probably really close to being out of theaters. I don't think it'll come back for Oscar season, but this is the kind of movie that definitely ends up on Netflix and that you should definitely check out. So try to keep Don't Think Twice on your radar. And unfortunately, I did not manage to catch Hell or High Water this week before the movie. So, before the podcast. So sad day on that, but I will be seeing that soon. So
Hell or High Water is good. It's a solid hour and a half. Did not a 5-star for me, but some great performances.
Cool.
Yeah. All right. That was good.
I think that's a good recap. Talked about some good movies. I like this part a lot. So we're going to take a quick break and come back to talk about heist movies.
Heist movies.
So you never wanted a regular type life.
The fuck is that? Barbecues and ball games?
Yeah.
This regular type life, that your life?
My life? No, my life. No, my life's a disaster zone. I got a stepdaughter so fucked up because her real father's this large type asshole. I got a wife. We're passing each other on the downslope of a marriage, my third. Because I spend all my time chasing guys like you around the block. That's my life.
Guy told me one time, don't let yourself get attached to anything you are not willing to walk out on in 30 seconds flat if you feel the heat around the corner. Now, if you're on me and you gotta move when I move, how do you expect to keep a marriage?
All right, so next we're gonna talk about Heat, which this week was brought to us by Billy. So Billy, why don't you tell us a little bit about why you assigned us Heat?
Yeah, so Heat is one of those movies that I think helped me realize how much I enjoyed this genre, the heist film, just sort of crystallized it for me. I want to say it's kind of underrated. I mean, you have two of the great actors of our time, De Niro and Pacino, kind of just before they took that 90s career dive that they both seemed to go into.
And their first on-screen appearance together.
Yes, yeah, even if it's just, what is that scene, 3 minutes, 4 minutes? Still, it's electrifying, it's thrilling. And it's better than the whatever, you know, 100 and whatever minutes of Righteous Kill that they did.
It's also better than the other 2 hours and 47 minutes of this movie. But
let's just wait a minute here, okay? Heat, yeah, I love for the way it builds suspense. I love for the alternating the cops and criminal storyline, and the way that you can really kind of cheer for both. Some great subplots with Val Kilmer and is that Ashley Judd, I wanna say?
Yes.
Yeah, just great cameos. And really, I think probably what I love most about this movie is Pacino yelling at Ashley Judd's. I want to say it's like Hank Azaria, the like second boyfriend. You guys remember the interrogation scene?
No, that's not Ashley Judd's second boyfriend. That's his wife. Ashley Judd plays.
No. This is the because she's got a great ass and your head is
okay yeah
you're all
right,
the way up it yeah no the scene sorry, where he walks right in on his wife's
I thought you were talking about the his wife's yeah okay
yeah
I gotcha.
Gets mad about the TV that's great too maybe we're skipping ahead but
so before we get too deep into talking about the best parts I'll wrap up the plot summary for those who did not catch up with us and spend the 3 hours watching Heat. Basically, at the beginning of the movie, Robert De Niro and his crew are setting up for a heist. And he's pulled together his crew, and just like in Reservoir Dogs, you always end up with like that one guy that you don't know really well. And that guy, Wayne Groh, is his name in the movie. I don't know who plays him. Kind of goes off kilter and just shoots one of the security guards when they had no reason to. And kind of botches the job a little bit. They get away with the money, but instead of it just being a burglary, now they've killed a man. And they've killed a lot of men. Yes, basically Joe Pesci from Goodfellas going crazy for no good reason. And so, you know, the Robert De Niro and his crew attempt to basically execute this guy, and the guy escapes and gets out. So that's one of the threads that follows throughout the whole movie. And at the same time, Al Pacino is a detective, a lieutenant, who is on to Robert De Niro and his crew and starts basically setting up surveillance. And when Robert De Niro and his crew go for their second job, Al Pacino is there, and he basically catches them in the act. But they call off the job because they notice the police surveillance and bail before they can really nail them on anything.
In a really good scene.
They could arrest them on, like, breaking and entering, but, like, they realize that's pretty useless. So they decide to keep up their surveillance. And even though Robert De Niro knows that they're onto him, he needs one last score because he's trying to, like, get out of the game forever. And so he decides that even though
he's in love,
which there's a lot of love in this movie, which I'll touch on after I get through the main plot. They decide to do one last bank job. So it's going to be a big job robbing a major bank. I believe the bank is owned by Gus Van Sant, who is also brought up later as basically he tries to kill Robert De Niro a little bit earlier, which I missed that because there's a lot that goes on in this movie. It's very plot heavy or story heavy, at least. So he tries to hit up that guy's bank specifically, but Wayne Grow, the escape person, basically comes to Gus Van Sant and gives him a little bit of that info. So they start working together type thing. So then we've got Robert De Niro trying to rob this other bad guy's bank who tried to kill him. Al Pacino's onto him. Robert De Niro knows that Al Pacino's onto him. And then there's a big bank heist. And that's the main heist in the movie, I'd say. And then there is the fallout from the bank heist. Because I think the bank heist kind of stretches out into the last 3 days that the movie covers. And at the same time, there is a whole series of subplots. Val Kilmer is one of the crew members, and he's risking basically losing his girlfriend to...
Ex-wife?
Okay, yeah. Thank you. And she has a... They have a child as well. And so he's trying to get her back. Every main male actor in this movie has a woman at home, and there has a like struggle with the relationship. Robert De Niro's in love, but his wife or his girlfriend wants him to leave the crime life behind. Al Pacino is in love, but his wife is coked out on Percocet and wants him to spend more time with her, but he's busy trying to like save the city from criminals.
In a direct quote of Al Pacino, he's on the downhill slide of his third marriage.
Yeah, and yeah. She also has Natalie Portman, who is a troubled daughter, who is in this movie. Natalie Portman's in it, which is awesome.
Her second movie.
Great early role for her.
The whole plot is good. That's why this movie's 3 hours long, because all of this is in there. It's directed by Michael Mann. This is a really well-made movie. To start the discussion off, basically, if you guys have been to our blog, you might have read my review of Along Came a Spider, where I talked about, I really have almost nothing bad I can say about this movie, but it just feels like like the most three-star movie of all time. It's just kind of completely average in every sense. Heat is that for four-star movies. I'm never going to be able to figure out a way to give this less than 3.5 or 4 stars because, like, it's just super well-made. But, man, do I not love anything about it either.
I went back and watched, so I've watched this twice now, because the first time I watched it in high school, I fell asleep because it's so long and it's so intricate. And I went back and rewatched it again that same time. And then in college, I was like, oh, I'll give it another chance. And I watched it. And I sort of get the same feeling where I was like, there's a lot going on. It's cool. So yeah, over the last week, I've been watching scenes of it and rereading plots and trying to get reviews and try to understand a little better. And when I watch individual scenes, it's so exciting. There's the scene where the second failed bank robbery happens, where they're trying to cut into a safe. And Robert De Niro is standing outside kind of watching around the building that Val Kilmer is cutting into the safe of. And he hears a noise and looks over at a truck that's the surveillance truck that all of the cops are in. And what the noise was, as you see from the inside of the truck, is one of the cops leans against the wall and his gun like taps the outside. It's like the sound of metal on metal quietly at 3 a.m. in an industrial part of town. Like, that could be anything. And it's great because another sort of on-screen scene you have is you have Al Pacino watching Robert De Niro on video camera. And it's not even actually on video camera. It's on like infrared. But even on infrared, you can see Robert De Niro hearing this noise and deciding that it's not worth the risk. He knows he's under surveillance and it's time to go. He walks in, grabs Val Kilmer, and says, "We walk," and everyone leaves. And it's just so intense because for like 10 seconds, you're like, did he hear the noise? Is he going to realize what it is? Are they going to walk? Are they going to keep going and get arrested? And then they get away. And then another amazing scene, I watched the entire heist. And part of the heist, Wayne Grow and Van Zant tip off the cops. So the cops show up at the heist. And they actually show this heist movie, this 10 minutes of it, to cops in L.A. for training. And there was an L.A. bank robbery where it's been speculated that the robbers watched Heat and used it as their motivation because it's done so well. There's so much knowledge that went into this. All the actors were given like months of firearms training. Michael Mann spent 7 months like in ride-alongs trying to learn about how cops work and how heists work. And this thing is shot so perfectly. It's exactly as a heist would pretty much play out. It's amazing.
Yeah. And unfortunately, I'm gonna throw this to Billy. Like, a lot of the things you talked about, what describes like the heist movie, what makes Ocean Eleven great, is I feel like there's barely a getting the team together situation here. Like, the team is together and then kind of falls apart together throughout the movie.
Yeah.
And so it's really hard to root for Robert De Niro for me because after, especially after the bank heist, which takes place at, like, the beginning of the third act is the big bank heist, they kill a lot of people. And, like, not just crooked cops or, like, people. They kill a lot of cops that you know are, like, have families and stuff. And you're like, what, like... It's really hard for me to be rooting for Robert De Niro at any part in the third act.
Yeah, there's a scene sure. where he's trying to get away in a grocery store and, like, firing wildly into a crowd of families.
Yeah, like, yeah. And, like, he's trying to help Val Kilmer get away. Like, I guess you could argue, but, like, not really. Like, he's just shooting at kids. Like,
your relationships with the characters definitely become complicated by their actions.
Yeah, which but, like, not good, Al... Think, right? To me, not Al Pacino. Like, I don't ever find myself not rooting for Al Pacino. Like, he seems like he's doing the right thing the whole time.
Uh-huh.
So I don't... I feel like... I think you're right that the movie wants me to be on both their sides. But I didn't... I just got pulled to Al Pacino's side and I stayed there. Yeah. Now, what I
well,
want...
Well, and I think if the shooting doesn't do it for you, it's the moment when, you know, the like, what is it, 30 seconds you have to be able to walk away.
They say that like four or five times in the movie.
Yeah, when it's if you measure out the screen time, it takes exactly 45 seconds for De Niro to walk away from his girlfriend. And that's really when he loses all sympathy.
And that's supposed to be like a super-ish kind of sad moment.
Val Kilmer too, about 30 seconds and he's turned around now.
Right.
But I don't know, like it didn't have super emotional impact for me because like I kind of feel bad for her. But, like, I didn't feel bad that Robert De Niro was missing out on that because, again, he deserved it. The scene, let's talk about, can we talk about the diner scene for a second, though? Because
yeah.
The diner scene is
fucking amazing.
Awesome. And I think you could have replaced the entire movie with Robert De Niro and Al Pacino having a sit down at this diner, and I would have watched it because that 3 or 4 minutes is so compelling.
It's
so
up with
good.
The eggplant scene from True Romance.
True Romance. It's one of... just like the greatest simple movie scenes of all time. And like, it's, you know, Al Pacino is like, look, this dude's already onto me. He caught me. I'm just going to go meet him face to face. And he just invites Robert De Niro, this heist, like kingpin to coffee. And they sit down and basically Al Pacino's like, look, you know, I'm onto you and I am onto you. And if you do anything, I'm going to have to bust you. Robert De Niro's like, well, I might be doing something, but you can't bust me. And Al Pacino's like, I like you, but if you do anything, I'll take you out. And Robert De Niro's, well, I'll take you out as well. I won't hesitate. And it's like, that's a terrible reenactment I just did. But I almost certainly put the audio of that at the top of this intro. So you all heard it. Just like, I don't know. I think that scene is what made this movie worth watching. I wish I didn't have to go through 3 hours to get to it. But it's so good. And nothing else in the movie lives up to that moment. Even the ending, which I think is supposed to be super impactful. And I think, Billy, for you, if you were on both sides of that, then the final Robert De Niro, Al Pacino confrontation probably hit you a lot harder than it hit me.
I like that diner scene so much because even just talking about it makes me want to rewatch the movie again just to get another take on it, because there's a great scene in it too where they're both describing like their love lives and like what they do, and they're like, he's like, I hate my love life is terrible, you know, both of them are like, oh well, I can't have any attachments, you know, this really sucks. And then they both look at each other and he goes, you're gonna retire, stop doing what you're doing? He goes, no, it's all I know how to do. And then the cop's like, yeah, me too, this is all I know how to do, so this is what I'm doing. And it's I don't know what the message is there quite yet. It's a little, maybe it's still too deep for me to really probe into, but there's something cool there that he's touching on, because these are both, they're not young cops or anything, they're young heist, this is a heist guy in his 40s and a cop that's easily in his 40s too, and so it's like kind of like almost a midlife crisis thing where both of them are like, well, I could walk away, I could do whatever, but what do? I've been doing this for 20-30 years, I don't know what else to do.
Yeah, and I think there's probably a lot of intricacies with like the way they're both, their relationships weave together, because they're both throughout the movie on the brink of losing their significant others, who you can tell they both actually care about. Like, they both start ending up in a situation where you're like, oh, Al Pacino's the good guy, but he lost his love, and Robert De Niro is the bad guy, but his love and him are still together. And then things like keep switching around of like who's together and who's going to be leaving each other through some weird subplots. The Natalie Portman thing, I still, I wish I had tracked that better throughout the movie, because it kind of came as a total shock to me that when, you know, that happens.
Yeah.
Being a little spoiler sensitive here, even though it's not really related to the plot and I've already ruined a lot more. So there's a video game called Payday 2. I assume there's a Payday 1, but Payday 2 is a video game where you and three friends are on a heist team together, and you go and commit crimes against computer enemies together, and the crimes are like randomly generated, so like the bank will have different layouts and stuff. And when I was watching this movie, I just wanted to be playing Payday 2, because Payday 2 feels exactly like the bank heist at the end of this movie. You, like, the first job in Payday 2 is called the bank job, and there's a small bank, and you go in and you can walk around as a normal person, and at some point you pull on your mask and then the heist is on, and you tie the cops up with like
zip ties.
Like, you do that in that game so that they don't call other people, and you drill into the safe. And, like, so while I was doing this, I was like, why? I could just be playing this right now, and I'd be a part of it. Like, because I love the case of the joint, the make the plan, and all of that. But I just didn't get invested into this enough that I wanted to just keep, you know, it's 3 hours long. It's just, it was all right.
What I'll say about the movie, it honestly, it never felt 3 hours to me. We were talking about Nolan earlier, right? And yes. I remember reading somewhere that before he started shooting The Dark Knight, he had the cast sit down for a screening of this movie, and he said, "This is the feeling I want to capture with The Dark Knight."
What's funny is, doesn't William Fichtner play Gus Van Sant in this movie? So you have him playing the guy who owns the bank
at the beginning,
beginning of Dark Knight as well.
Which, by the way, the beginning of The Dark Knight might be the best hype movie ever.
Oh, that's a good point. Like, just the intro of Dark Knight is the greatest heist movie ever made.
Yeah, fair point. But yeah, that's, for me, Heat was the tension and the suspense and the great performances of The Dark Knight without capes or clown makeup.
Like Dave said, I think that when I think back on scenes of this movie, I'm really glad they all exist. The diner scene, the bank job itself is actually really impressive heist. Like, it's fun. It's just so short, and when the actual think about all the stuff that happens, it feels like there's a lot of... It feels like Michael Mann needed a better editor to someone help him cut this out, because I don't know if I need the Charlene, the Natalie Portman, the Ashley Judd, the Al Pacino's wife subplot, and the subplot with, like, De Niro's girlfriend. Like, I need all four of those about the women in their life? And I feel like maybe I missed something.
We're talking about this now, and if it had been made in the mid-2010s, it might be an HBO series.
Yeah, I could see that.
Given all these subplots. And that might be amazing.
Maybe if you just made a cut of this movie that took out almost all of the Val Kilmer plots. It kind of ties in. Like, you kind of almost can't, because of like how the Charlene's other lover falls into the end of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I want them to pare that down a little bit. And if I like Robert De Niro and Al Pacino having that, because it humanizes them and tries to get to that point that Billy, you got to, of like wanting them both to succeed, so that the ending is really impactful. Because the ending is like the handhold at the end is supposed to be this whole like,
yeah,
they get each other moment.
Loved that.
But like, for me, it was just like, oh, Al Pacino is like, all right, it's over. I'm just going to do this for this guy because he's about to.
No, I'm with Billy. I loved that. Yeah.
I don't know.
One quick question on this. So it's 94. It's almost 20 years old now. 94, I think. Does this movie hold up 20 years old now?
Yes.
I would say so.
Yeah.
What about the soundtrack? Because I seem to remember feeling the soundtrack was a little...
I don't even recall the score soundtrack.
There's some scenes where like Robert De Niro and Val Kilmer are talking about like their respective girlfriends or whatever. And there's some scenes where Edie, which is Robert De Niro's love interest, and Neil, are talking, and like the music just felt really strong. Like it was kind of forcing me to be like mushy. Mostly in the love scenes, because a little on the head with the love half of this plot. And it's interesting because I keep coming back to a comparison between The Town and Heat, because for me, The Town is 2 hours long, and it pairs out a lot of this love interest stuff, because you've got the love interest between Ben Affleck and his girl, but there's no one else has a love interest. You get to know their plots a little better and what they are motivated by, but it's kind of similar. We've got an already established crew doing bank heists. They do three heists pretty much, sort of the same way. He's got a love interest. Is he going to take her with her? What's going to happen there? And we've got John Hamm on the other side. Not as much about John Hamm as well. I think The Town is a good mirror of let's take out all those love plots except for one or two. And it doesn't feel as strong, I don't think. The intensity is still there.
Town has almost no heart for me when I watch it.
I feel like we've really talked David up during the recording of this because I know I was talking to him beforehand. And
you have.
I think we've brought him back to the fold. Here's my final just summary of Heat because I think we've said a lot about it. I don't know if anyone has anything more to say, but I'll let you guys wrap up as well. Mm-hmm. I think that this movie has such a strong collection of performances and scenes. You have the Robert De Niro being great as always. Like, this is definitely prime De Niro in a role that he's super comfortable in, playing a fun kind of bad guy. You have Al Pacino, who gets to not only interact with Robert De Niro in a super fun way, but has, like, two of the greatest Al Pacino scenes this side of...
The Godfather 2?
To me, no. We did it on this podcast.
What are you talking about?
What movie do we... What high school movie?
Scent of a Woman.
Oh, Scent of a Woman.
I'm on, like, 4 hours of sleep, guys. I'm sorry. Yes. This has the greatest Al Pacino performances this side of Scent of a Woman. Like,
you meant Devil's Advocate, which I also assigned to you.
You did. You've assigned me a lot of Al Pacino doing crazy acting things, which I love. You know. And by the way, it's great that both these guys are having a renaissance in their career right now. I don't know if anyone else considers Al Pacino there yet, but I know that on this specific podcast, we love Danny Collins, and we're super hype about it. So Al Pacino's back. Robert De Niro has been having a pretty...
Back.
He's, you know, Silver Linings Playbook. He's got some stuff. He's got, he's got American Hustle.
That grandfather movie with...
Okay. I'm not saying he's all the way back.
Let's pretend that didn't happen.
But, you know, he's going to be in a Bradley Cooper-directed movie soon. I don't know. I'm just... let him come back. I want Al Pacino, I want Robert De Niro back before they're gone forever.
All right.
So, like, I think all of those things are what drag this movie, like I said, kicking and screaming for me up into... It's still a really good movie. Because if the same plot was tried to take on by anyone who wasn't as quality as Michael Mann... It would be a really bad movie. The same way that The Departed only succeeds because Martin Scorsese is so good that he can make that work.
Yeah.
This movie is for me. And so my review, I'm going to give it the star rating so we can keep this show moving. It's a 4-star movie at the very bottom of 4 stars, but it is a 4-star movie. So I do think it holds up. I do think you can still watch this movie today and enjoy Heat.
Mine is at the very top of 4 stars. So there you have it.
I'm so torn here because I started off with Josh beforehand saying, I don't know, it might be a 2-star movie because I love the scenes a lot, but I can't recall, like, I don't love the plot follow through. But now that we're talking about it, all right, I'm going to go with a 4-star movie actually now, but with a caveat because I want to rewatch this movie again. I know I've watched it twice already, but I feel like if I watch it a third time, I'm going to really enjoy it. So I think it's 4. It might be a 5-star movie. I think I need another rewatching.
It might be that for me too. Like in the same way that The Martian was, where it just like I just feel it in my gut. You know,
that's how 5 stars should be.
It feels deeper than I should. Like with I'm gonna compare it to another Al Pacino movie because he's apparently my go-to. But The Godfather took me 3 watchings to really delve into every piece of it and really, really love it. And I've now watched it probably about 13 or 14 times because I love that movie. And I think The Heat is kind of the same way. It's just got so much going on. I think I need to give it, you know, 3 or 4 watchings to really get the depth of it. And I just haven't given it that homework yet. So right now it's a 4-star movie, but it could very easily become a 5-star.
Yeah, I've only watched The Godfather once too, and I don't love it because, again, I've only watched it once.
We'll watch it 4 more times.
No, the thing is I don't want to do that with movies I don't love. And that's probably why I end up on this other side of you guys. Well, like... slightly other side of you guys from Heat. This is one of the first movies that we've done for this that I haven't watched twice before we've recorded. I try to do that because for that exact reason, but it's just like that runtime is so intimidating for me. Okay, I think that pretty much wraps up Heat though. Anyone have any last minute thoughts they want to say?
We're going to do a new podcast where we make you watch The Godfather 3 more times. And we talk about it after every time.
Is it going to be like the worst idea ever, but with The Godfather?
Yeah, so it's like the most mediocre idea ever.
it's a slight... All right, well, my last thought for Heat is please don't make me watch Casino. All right,
oh, God,
so,
hate it. Never.
Now we're going to take a break and come back with Run Lola Run, which is a very different movie than Heat, so I'm excited to change it. All right.
bist du?
In der Zelle, in der Innenstadt. In meiner Spirale.
Alles klar, bleib, wo du bist. Mir fällt was ein, ich schwör's. 20 Minuten, okay?
Ach was, ich gehe jetzt einfach darüber zum Bollern und dann hole ich mir die 100.000.
Schwachsinn, hör auf damit.
Wieso? Ronja hat gesagt, die machen 200.000 am Tag und jetzt ist Mittag, dann muss doch die Hälfte da sein.
Du spinnst, du tust überhaupt nichts. Du bleibst genau in deiner verdammten Zelle und ich komm jetzt.
Wir machen Überfall, was sonst?
Hast du einen Knall? Ey, du machst gar nichts. Du bleibst genau da und ich komm jetzt.
Ja, und dann, hä?
Dann helfe ich dir, mir fällt immer was ein.
Mann, Lola, wach auf, in 20 Minuten bin ich entweder tot oder ich gehe jetzt da rein und hol mir das Geld.
Nein, warte.
Warum denn?
Weil ich es will. Ich helfe dir, ich krieg das Geld.
Um 12 gehe ich da rein, naja, warte ich nicht. Oh, oh.
So that German you just heard was Run Lola Run. We're going to talk about this one this week. So I was the one who decided to add Run Lola Run because it's a movie I was meaning to watch for a long time. So when we started talking about heist movies, I immediately jumped on and watched the copy of it. I have, because I own this movie, but I just hadn't watched it. At the end, I was like, not sure this is going to pass for a heist movie, but I'm going to try and sneak it in because it's a movie I wanted to talk about with you guys and make you guys watch. So Run Lola Run, Dave, why don't you tell us what it's all about?
Josh Glick, bending the rules, always.
He's a maverick.
Yeah, yeah. Run Lola Run is like an hour and 5 minutes long. It's an exceedingly short movie, but it's really quite good for that short runtime. So how the movie opens is you've got Lola and her boyfriend. Her boyfriend might be Nick Kroll in a German universe, and Lola, I believe, is the girl from Fifth Element in a German universe.
Also the girl from The Bourne Identity.
Yes. What we end up with is Lola gets called by her boyfriend, and he says, through a series of misadventures, basically, he lost a ton of money and needs to have it in 10 minutes. Otherwise, the drug dealer I think they work for will have him killed. And she's part of the reason they lost the money was that after he makes the deal, he has all the cash, and Lola was supposed to pick him up and drive him to where he's supposed to meet the guy. But Lola's bike got stolen, and so she wasn't able to meet him. And because her bike got stolen, he took the train. When he was on the train, some police saw him, and he kind of freaks out and hops off the train, leaving his money on the train, which a hobo then grabs. So he's lost the money now because Lola wasn't there to pick him up. And so Lola freaks out because they have 15 minutes to get like $100,000, I believe, which is a lot of money.
I think we might be burying the lead here, guys, which is the weird, fun storytelling thing that
yes,
this movie does.
Which I was getting to. So the big thing here is that what happens is it starts off where they decide she's running around, and why it's called Run Lola Run because she has no method of transportation, so she's running everywhere, trying to get money from her dad. She goes and meets her boyfriend up, who's already held up a grocery store trying to get the money. They hold up the grocery store. They run out. And the police kill Lola. And you're now 30 minutes of the movie, and Lola is dead. And you're left, like me, thinking, well, the fuck just happened? What is this movie about? And then we get into the cool storytelling technique that Billy just referenced, is that once Lola dies, the whole movie restarts. And we get to see the whole thing with a few slight differences. What if she had made a couple of different choices? What happens? And this happens three times, and you get basically three retellings of the same 45-minute stretch, essentially, of them trying to get this $100,000, two of which end badly, one of which ends really well.
The interesting thing is the decision, I think, that changes each time is, and it, like, there's this weird animated section of every single thing that starts off each moment. In the animated portion of each one, there's a person in the hallway with a pit bull that, like jumps out and barks at her, or the person, like, trips her in one of them. Like, it's her interaction with that person in her hallway that like is what sets off the three different, I think people call them runs, people who really like this movie, because this is super cult movie. Like, it's German, it's from 1999, but I think the people who've seen and liked this movie really like this movie, so there's a lot of jargon around it.
The interesting thing about it, too, is that while she's running, she keeps running into people. So there's a guy on a bike who's, like, offering to sell her the bike for, like, 60, 70 bucks. There's a lady in a baby with a baby carriage pushing her child along, and as she runs into these people make different decisions on what exactly to say to her, what exactly to do. And as a result of those different decisions, they end up in different situations too. Like the lady with the baby at one point turns around and is like, fuck you, when she runs by him. And then it shows her future through a series of snapshots. And in that future, like, her child gets taken away by Child Protective Services, whatever German that is, Kinder.
Some sort of social services.
Yeah. And then she ends up like poor and destitute. And then in like another one, she wins the lottery and she has like this huge mansion. And I don't remember the third one, but it's interesting because like they have all these different, like everything is
it all matters almost nothing to the plot, except it's like it's the butterfly effect storyline of like how these little changes can affect your life. So like those characters you're talking about don't honestly matter almost at all to what's going on, but it is really interesting. And it's like a really, this is a super stylized movie. If resetting the whole film and taking place, so Lola only has 20 minutes to meet Manny before he's supposed to drop off the money. And so that's why each of the three runs is almost exactly 20 minutes long, which is how you get just over an hour of plot. I think there's a little bit of extra time there because like sometimes she meets him at 20 minutes and then there's slightly more that happens. The main thing in the plot that you kind of touched on was the place where she goes for the money in almost each of the cases is she runs to her dad, who owns a bank, or it's a
bank. It's like a CEO in a bank or something
He runs the bank, whatever it is. And like he is in the middle of having a fight with his mistress who wants him to leave Lola and her mother and like come away with her. And so you get to see her interaction with her dad, who clearly is in a weird spot with her three different times. And it's like always sad and emotional and really awkward. I got really wrapped up in seeing that over and over the slight differences, like you said.
And it's interesting, like by the third time you've watched it, you know where everyone is going to be at the appointed time when he has to meet the guy. And so it's interesting because you're like, okay, now she runs past the truck. Oh, now she jumps over the car. Now she sees the bicycle guy. Like, you know all the details of what's happening and you can pick out those little differences. It's like when you rewatch Usual Suspects is a bad example because they don't do a lot of foreshadowing, but any
Prestige.
Kind of
Prestige. Yeah, I knew I could fit it in this episode.
There you go. If you rewatch The Prestige and see all the foreshadowing of what's happening at the end, it's the same thing because now you get to see all these little differences. It's like the like one of those like find the difference between two pictures because you see the same thing. You're like, oh, this time she just jumped over the car instead of getting hit by it or whatever, and then you get to see how that all plays out.
Or this time she's limping, so she was a little bit late to that same meet spot.
Exactly, and now she didn't make it in time.
Yeah, and so like her dad is already gone when she gets there because I don't know. The thing that's really interesting is that in between the three runs, you get little glimpses of Lola and Manny's relationship. Like, so that's why the movie's a little over the hour runtime, because each of those takes 20 minutes. But then there's like a 5-minute vignette from their relationship in each of them, because in run number one, Lola dies. In run number two, Manny dies. And then run number three, they're together. Like they live, which is obviously a very deliberate choice by the filmmaker. But so when Lola's dying, her last thought is of her and Manny in one situation. And when Manny's dying, his last thought is of her, Lola, and him in a different situation. And so that was really also interesting, like, see that, like, you get that entire, you understand them as a couple by the end of the movie through 2 5-minute scenes. And obviously the fact that she's doing this for him. And I found that really, like, well done filmmaking-wise. It's really impressive.
Yeah, this is a very, it's a clever movie, right? These kinds of, like, branching alternate timeline stories. I feel like it's one of those things that just, you can do it in the written word, but it's never going to be as compelling or as like interestingly done as it is in the quick flashes you get in movies, right?
If anyone really enjoys the Remedial Chaos Theory episode of Community, which is the one where they roll the dice and depending on who has to go get the pizza, different things play out, that is this movie. Like, that movie,
sure.
that episode is clearly influenced by this movie. Like, down to the fact that in Run Lola Run, you see, like, the phone dropping every time as, like, the start of the reset. And in the episode of Remedial Chaos Theory, it's a dice being rolled. Like, I think that was a clear direct influence.
Some direct references, for sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
Except this one's set with German electropop.
Yeah. Yeah. Did anyone watch the dubbed version, by the way?
I did.
I started with the dubbed version before I realized, because like the beginning of the movie is like this narrator talking over everything, so it's really hard to figure out it's dubbed until like 10 minutes in when you like see their mouths aren't matching up anymore. And so I switched to the German version after
that. Go with subtitles every time. Dubbed versions are...
Unless it's animated. Unless it's animated.
What's that?
Unless it's an
animated. Yeah, oh yeah. Well, yeah.
Then you can fix it.
I liked the dubbed version. It was fine.
Okay.
What's wrong with dubbed versions?
I don't like... I feel like I lose the acting. I feel like, because it's really hard to figure out with someone's, like, that's the whole joke about the old, you know, kung fu movies, right? Is like, this person's like, I scream a lot, blah, 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 blah. And then it's like, yes, master, I shall do that thing. And you're like, oh. So I don't know. I just kind of lose the original acting a little bit in the dubbed or sub. This is our first foreign film. I was super happy to drag that in. I didn't tell anyone ahead of time it was foreign. I don't watch a lot of German movies normally. So this was an interesting peek into that.
Hmm. This is probably the only German movie that I've seen.
You haven't seen Downfall?
I have not
seen Downfall. But, you know, it's been on the list. Mostly because of that, you know...
the memes.
Fad. Yeah, videos.
We watched it in German class in high school. I think because my German professor or teacher was trying to absolve guilt. But, you know, whatever.
That'll happen. Yeah. No, I watched this freshman year of college. And I feel like it's very much that movie you watch when you first go to college that expands your horizons of what filmmaking can be. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. This is a definitely that movie that is sort of like this weird, it's foreign for the first time maybe, or, you know, she's got red hair and it's like very like, it's the indie films, the like, but I don't know, it's one of the best indie films probably ever.
It is really cool too, because it takes a very simple plot of, in 20 minutes, I need to get this amount of money to my boyfriend who is at this spot.
Yeah.
And even the interactions are simple. I mean, she goes to her father to get money, and it's not like she's doing anything crazy or weird, but then they tell it in such an interesting way that it makes the movie really interesting.
Yeah, it's like a kind of Memento, where if you just plotted this movie out, it wouldn't be as good, but because they use the techniques of great storytelling that it ends up being, or Pulp Fiction maybe is another good example.
Definitely.
Yeah.
If you were to like cut Pulp Fiction linearly, it would not be as good of a movie, because you need the like jumping back and forth and understanding where someone is, like in your mind, you're doing the mental gymnastics of putting people in the right place.
Yeah.
Netflix would definitely file it under mind bending cerebral movies or something like that.
I will. So here, quick argument following our heist movie plot to just defend why I consider this a heist movie. First off, there is a getting to the gang together scene. It's literally the first phone call. It lasts about 2.5 minutes. It's Manny calling Lola, but that's them getting the small gang together. More
I
than
see
Heat
you
had.
Cringing right now.
More than Heat had. There is at least two robberies that are, you know, like stick-ups. One's a stick-up, one's a bank. They're both stick-ups. I don't know if stick-ups count as heist. There's not much elaborate planning into it, but it is definitely that. And you definitely are rooting for the bad guys to succeed. You want them to because you like them enough.
Everyone else's assholes too.
Yeah.
There are some elements, Josh, we'll give to you. It's more of a ticking clock movie than it is a heist movie. Everyone
agreed.
Split hairs here, I guess.
No, it's more of a lot of things than it is a heist movie.
Yeah, but the elements are there. We'll give it to you.
I don't know. I'm really glad that we did this, because compared to things like Heat or Ocean's 11, I think this movie brought something that I hadn't seen before. In the like you said, the heist starts going wrong. This movie is what if the heist goes wrong, but we could redo the whole thing.
But there are an infinite number of timelines in the universe.
It's important to point out she doesn't like come back with like any extra knowledge. They seem to be, like you said, completely separate stories.
I do have one question on that. There is one piece of knowledge she brought from one of the timelines to the other, and I'm not sure if that means that there is a knowledge that they bring or not. So in the very first run, she's in the grocery store and Manny gives her a gun and he says, take the safety off. And she says, what? And he said, it's a little knob here. Turn that down. Now you can fire it. In the second run, then, when she's holding a bank robbery by herself, she shuts the safety off by herself. There's a scene where her dad looks at her and says, you don't know how to use that gun. And then she switches she looks down at the gun and switches the safety off. Is that just luck? Or did she take that information? It's the only thing I could find between the runs that's like, oh, she learned.
That is a brand new piece of information for me. I'm now remembering all of the stuff you just said, and that is like, now I want to go rewatch this. Like, I need to find out if there's anything more like that in there. That's actually, I know. Even if it was just that, that's such an interesting wrinkle to add to this, is like, maybe it's not. Maybe Lola has the power to reset the time and do this. And
what was the deal with the scream? Because she screams a couple times in each movie and glass explodes and amazing things happen when she does it.
Yeah, she has superpowers of some kind. She's the Banshee.
There's something going on there.
The whole movie hinges on her interactions with those reoccurring characters. So you have Manny.
Yeah.
You have the guard at the bank is probably one of the best ones, actually.
Yeah, it is.
And his plot takes a very different turn based on what's going on. Whether he's out front when she shows up or he's at the door into, like... the bank has, like, a secure internal security guard that has, like, a flat wall door that he has to pop open. That's pretty crazy.
So final thoughts on this movie. Yeah. What are you thinking, Billy?
For me, like, seeing it in college was awesome. For me now, it's 3 stars, honestly. Like, yeah, it's cool. Like, I would rewatch it if it were put in front of me. But I guess what interests me now in movies is different from what I thought was interesting at 18. Cool stuff. But for me, there's not much depth to go back to. Despite, I mean, what you just said, like, that's a cool discussion, but in terms of, like, the depth of the characters, there's, you know, there's not a whole lot there, which is fine. So 3 for me.
I'm going to agree with you on that. I think there are some cool, like, what are the techniques that move from place to place, and what is this actually, what's the cool thing she can do? And I might watch it again a second time just to kind of see if I can pick up on any of that stuff, but I agree the characters are cool and they're developed, but they're not super round and they don't have a lot going on.
It's a cool movie.
It's a cool movie. And yeah. I think if someone said, let's watch this again, I'd watch it, but I'm not going to go out and buy it. And I recommend that everyone watch it at least once. It's definitely a good movie and worth the one watch, but it's for me a 3-star movie.
I don't think there's going to be a lot of arguments on this episode because you guys kind of nailed everything I thought. This is a fun enough movie that I'm not going to mind watching it again. I'm pretty sure it will come back to me at some point, whether it's something I want to show somebody else or, you know, it just shows up on my random shuffling of movies I do. I think that, like, you guys pretty much hit the nail on the head with the characters. They are good enough that this movie is good movie, but there's just, because they only have 30 minutes of story, even if it's 3 different times, there's so much overlap in those stories that they really only get that much development. And it's really impressive how much they're developed in that time. But it's still like watching the first or second episode of a sitcom where you've only had so long to be with these characters. You're not going to be totally in love with them yet. Yeah. I think I liked it a little better than you guys. I would give this a 4-star because I think the style is impressive enough to carry it. Like you said, there's all the other elements are there to the degree you can expect them to be. I kind of wish this was a 5-star movie. Like, if the roundness had somehow shown through more, it would have been better. And even if I go back and, Dave, what you say is true, and you get into this really interesting of, like, are there multiple timelines and can they influence each other? And, like, what is the power of love that's making this happen somehow? Because it only resets when one of them dies. Even if all of that's true, I don't think it would make up for the fact that this is still an 83-minute experience. One that you should have, but it's not going to be something like The Prestige that I want to go back to over and over and over and over and over because of the scenes and the characters and all of that. So I give it a 4-star, and I think that pretty much wraps up heist movies for us. Anyone want to say something else? All right, I guess then, Billy, we're going to turn it over to you to hear that sweet, sweet monologue.
One of my favorite heist scenes in a movie isn't in a heist movie. It's in Neighbors, the Seth Rogen, Zac Efron comedy from a few years back. There's this scene about 2/3 of the way through the movie where Seth Rogen and his wife, Rose Byrne, and their friend, they are trying to manipulate Zac Efron's girlfriend into sleeping with his best friend, played by Dave Franco, which sounds much more twisted than it is in its presentation in the movie. But they need Zac Efron to walk in while this is happening, and so for that to happen, everything has to be timed perfectly. So you have them, you know, you have the shots of, you know, planning things out, and everything has to be the right timing.
And there's, of course, the moment where you think that it's not going to work. I don't want to give too much away if you haven't seen it, but to me it's easily the best part of the movie. And I think that it shows how popular the idea of the heist is and how well-loved it is in the culture. Moments like this often get injected into narratives for some excitement. I made an attempted heist in the principal's office for a bunch of seventh graders, the climax of my master's thesis. Heists are adventures to adults the same way that dragons or spaceships are to children. We get older and our idea of adventure turns to misbehavior. Let's order those loaded fries for the table. Let's get that second round of drinks. We feel good about these things because our behavior in these cases is often victimless. And this is the way that movie heists go. The only victims in these crimes are faceless corporations or the oily, slick businessman. George Clooney in Ocean's 11 is as much the fox from Robin Hood as he is a silver fox. But when we're grown-ups, one of the things that we have to come to realize is that too often our bad behavior is not victimless. Too often it hurts people who depend on us or the people that we care about the most. And I think that perhaps one of the reasons for the enduring popularity of heists, whether as movies on their own or injected into narratives, is that this idea that you can do bad things and you will be loved not just despite of them, but because of them.
We want to reclap?
Yep.
Reclap! Okay.
This is a reclap.
That was an air horn.
John Cena. All right.